Hi, it's Jonathan Cotton with the Good Feet Store, and you know what time of year it is? It's back to school time, and time once again for all of those after school activities. Whether it's ballet or football, drama or field hockey, band or basketball, kids' feet need to feel good. Those cleats, sneakers, or shoes for band often don't do those young feet any favors. If our kids are going to stay active and healthy, then they need good feet. That means it's also time to take your kids to the Good Feet Store. Yeah, that's right, the young ones, the kids. Bring them into the Good Feet Store and let's treat them to some personal service. Our team members will measure their feet and find the right arch support for them. They can still wear the shoes they want, but they will have the support to make them comfortable now and keep their feet healthy for the future. It won't take long, and it could change their life. Go to goodfeet.com to make an appointment or just stop by the location nearest you. The Good Feet Store.
You know I'm right. Nick Durst here with Joe Calabrese. Joe, I'm very excited for our guest today. A non-consequential part of his life, it was big for me. When I was an intern with Madison Square Garden, I got to come for one game in the broadcast booth during the renovation. Got to sit between him, his partner on the radio team. I got to get him and all the broadcasters hot pretzels in between intermissions. And it was so cool back in 2013. But Joe, why don't you let everybody know who our guest is today?
He is a former NHL and WHA defenseman. He won a couple of national championships at the University of Minnesota. An on-ice level reporter and analyst for a really long time. And he's currently the color commentator for our New York Rangers. Working with Sam Rosen. The season's coming up. We're going to have a really, really fun time with him. Joe Micheletti. Joe, welcome to the show. Thank you for finally coming on with us. How are you today?
Yeah, Joe, I'm great. Thank you. And Nick, thank you guys for having me on. I appreciate it. Nick, you know who loves those pretzels, right? I mean, that's Sam.
Sam loves those pretzels.
He's good for the rest of the night.
He was excited. I came back. Had like a stack of four going for the four of you there, Kenny, Dave, you and Sam. And I was thrilled to do it. I was thrilled to do it. And what a treat to go to be able to eat in the press box too. As a college kid, the hot pretzels are good, really good at Madison Square Garden. What are the best things there?
Yeah, things have changed a little bit. I remember what you're talking about. We were all on that one level in that spot there. We're kind of right in the middle of the fans here. They were still trying to finish up the garden, and we weren't able to get on what is just one of the great broadcast positions in the league now, the Chase Bridge. And so, but I remember those days, found a lot of wires around there and a lot of people hanging around.
Yeah. I was sitting with, the radio producer, Frank. I was like, wires going all around me. And it was a good time though. I mean, everybody was close and, you know, you guys aren't really like, it's a different view, I guess, being up higher now, more you can see the whole ice, but renovation was fantastic.
Yeah.
So we wanted to ask you here before we get into some current things, with your playing career and growing up and playing, of course, Minnesota, you got to play hockey there. When did you realize that you may potentially have the chance to go pro playing hockey?
Well, I was born in International Falls, Minnesota, right up on the main border. Across the river was Fort Frances, Ontario, but grew up 100 miles south in a place called Hibbing, Minnesota. Bob Dylan and Kevin McHale from the Boston Celtics, Kevin has been a good friend of our family for a long time, and so here's one of the greatest basketball players of all time that grew up in Hibbing. It was actually a hockey player until he was about ninth grade, and then had this surge in height, so he stopped playing. But so we used to, on Saturday nights, we used to sit around the television. We only had three stations at the time, and we used to get the Hockey Night in Canada broadcast of Montreal and Toronto. Mostly is what we grew up watching, and I guess we all kind of dreamed about it at that time. But my mother was the one that, because I was a good player when I was young, and she was the one that always used to say, "Oh, you're going to be a pro. You're going to be a pro." So, but that was my mother. She was a saint, and she had to be with 9 kids, right? And so, so she was the one that kept saying, "Oh, you're going to be a pro." And you know, then when I went to the University of Minnesota, you know, I played for Herb Brooks for 4 seasons, and he told me I'd never play, but that was part of Herb, right? As we all know from following him and what he did with the 1980 U.S. Olympic team, and how he was such a smart guy and being able to motivate players and push the right buttons. And so he would say, you know, when I got drafted, he said, the Montreal Canadiens drafted you, but don't even think about it. You've got no chance of playing. This was right after my freshman season. So so anyway, it wasn't until later as I developed playing for Herb that, you know, that there started to be, I started to get a little bit of interest. I was drafted in both the WHA and the NHL, and thought that there was an inside chance, let's put it that way.
So you mentioned Herb. Do you think he was accurately portrayed in the movie Miracle?
You know, Nick, I've been asked that question before, and I will say to you that I have never watched the movie.
Okay.
I say that Herb, I had a special relationship with Herb. My family had a very special relationship with Herb. My brothers and my sisters were like brothers and sisters to him. My parents, he was like a son to my parents. And he went, you know, I lost both my parents, and both times there just happened to be a blizzard in northern Minnesota. And both times Herb said, you know, had called me and said, "Sorry, I can't get there." One time he was scouting for the Pittsburgh Penguins, and was had just arrived in Montreal to start a 3-week scouting trip, and said, you know, "Sorry about your mom, but I'm not gonna be able to get there." Of course, both times, guess who shows up, drives through a blizzard through northern, you know, from Minneapolis, St. Paul to Hibbing, which is normally about a 4-hour drive. And I was one of his pallbearers at his funeral. So I just never watched the movie. And you know, I met Kurt Russell and a lot of those players on the 1980 team. I was either teammates with or friends with most of them. And Buzz Schneider in particular told me that he thought that the movie did a real good job of representing what that was about and Herb as well. And I know Kurt Russell told me that he spent hours and hours with Herb, and Herb was great for him at helping him prepare for the part. So anyway, everyone I've spoken to said it was done tremendously.
So we're going a little bit out of order here, but following your playing career.
I'm sorry for going on and on.
No, you're totally fine. You actually ultimately ended up becoming a coach in the league for a couple of years. So I wanted to ask if you brought elements of what Herb was as a coach to your experience when you had the opportunity to do so.
Not enough, because there was only one Herb, and it actually, you know, it took me 4 years to try and really get to know him. And so there was only, you know, Herb was so good at being able to figure out people right away and players and what makes them tick and how to motivate and what you can and can't do, what you can't say, and how you can be tough on some players and not on others. So I wasn't a head coach. And so that's the job of a head coach, to really be able to do that. So as an assistant, you spend more time one-on-one with players, looking at video, going over some things, talking one-on-one. But very seldom do you address the team, or at least back then, that wasn't it. So the only thing I can say is I learned a lot from Herb. I wish I would have learned more. I wish more would have rubbed off on me, because it would have made me a better coach and probably a better person as well.
So obviously he impacted your career greatly there. You get drafted by two leagues. You end up making your debut in the WHA, and then later on you go to the NHL. What do you remember about getting the call that's saying, hey, you're gonna play tonight for the big team?
Well, what happened was my rights had been, I was with Calgary in the World Hockey Association. And my senior season was the year that a lot of those Olympic kids were freshmen at the University of Minnesota. Rob McClanahan, Phil Verkota, Bill Baker, I think was a sophomore, Steve Kristoff, Eric Strobel, my younger brother who didn't make the team, but there was that whole group of guys that were freshmen with me went on to play for that Olympic team. So we were a team that was in transition. I mean, we were really struggling just to make the playoffs. And this is after, Joe, I know you mentioned, this is after the three previous seasons, our team made it to the championship game, the NCAA championship game. We won two and lost one. And so this was a real change for us not to be one of the top teams in the country. So this was a grind. I mean, it was, and Herbie was really grinding on us to, you know, pushing us. So we barely got in and made the playoffs. And so because we barely got in, we had to play the number one seed, which was University of Notre Dame. They were the number one rated team in the country. And so we had to play our two game series in the playoffs at Notre Dame. And it was a total goals two game series. So it wasn't whoever won one. You had to, you know, it was whoever scored the most goals in two games. So we got beat the Friday night, the first game, 5-1. And I remember getting a call back in the room at the hotel room after the game late. It was about midnight. Joe Crozier was the coach and the general manager of the Calgary Cowboys. And he called me that night and said, we plan on getting you signed right after the game tomorrow and flying you here the next day. And I said to him, I said, Joe, we're not finished yet. And we went on to beat Notre Dame the next night, 7 or 8-1. And what was one of the huge upsets, certainly that season. And then we ended up losing to Wisconsin, who went on to win the national championship. But that was the first call I received. And then after losing, he called me back and said, okay, are you ready now? So I left, you know, I left the next day. And, you know, one of my good buddies I played with at the University of Minnesota, and who also played for the Rangers, was a guy by the name of Warren Miller. So that helped out when I signed and got there. The day I got there, I played my first game. So it was just a great thrill.
Yeah, I could imagine. And I wanted to ask you about the end of your playing career. You ended playing for Team USA. 1982, you're in the Ice Hockey World Championship. What was it like, you know, just playing for the national team at that point, obviously coming off 2 years earlier, the biggest win in the program's history?
Yeah, it was great because I was lucky enough to play twice. I played in 77 for Team USA in the World Championships in Vienna. And in fact, Dave Maloney, who I worked with with the Rangers, and Dave, of course, was a former captain of the Rangers, played for Team Canada that year in 77 as well. So we've often spoken about playing in Vienna, Austria, and playing in those. It's hard to describe how it is playing for your country in those things. I don't think what Team USA did in 1980 had really caught on yet. What it did was, I think it got everything going. And it got kids interested all over the country. So we really didn't see the fruits of their labor until later on, and what the impact of that was. And now we're seeing it, you know, we see it now every year, the number of U.S. kids that are taken in the first round, you know, where they play, Florida, Arizona, California. You know, we'd seen very little. In fact, when I played back, you know, back in those days, I think the percentage of U.S. players was maybe 3% of all NHL players, maybe 3 or 4%. So there was hardly any of us from the U.S. that was playing. But it was really later on that, you know, that Team USA doing what they did at the Olympics in 1980, really, we really start seeing the fruits of that effort by them.
Yeah, I can definitely imagine, you know, the caught on the impact, and then probably that, and then Gretzky going to the Kings probably had the biggest impact on U.S. hockey, migrating and getting players all over. But it's something really special about the international game and, you know, playing for your country. And luckily, the next Olympics, we're going to see the NHL players back in the Olympics. Is that something that you support, or do you like having it where it's amateurs? And also, you know, how excited were you, or what was your experience like in 1994 when you did your first Olympics with Jiggs McDonald for TNT?
It was fabulous. It really was, because I am a fan of amateurs, because you won't see another Michael Ruzzioni. Mike is such a wonderful guy, but never had the type of overall talent where people thought the guy's going to be a star in the National Hockey League. But he had obviously a huge heart and leadership abilities and that kind of thing. And for him to do what he, what he did, you don't see that. You're not going to see that again with amateurs. So I miss that part of it. But at the same time, it means so much to the pro players to go over there and represent their countries and to try and get a gold medal. I mean, this is really important for them. I mean, when all this was going down with the new collective bargaining agreement, I mean, the players were saying, we want to play in the Olympics. Get that in there. That's got to be part of the agreement. So they forced that in. And I think overall, you know, I can look at it different ways. First of all, I think first and foremost, if you're looking at it from a standpoint of the growth of hockey, I think it has tremendous value. Other people don't. I think it does. I think that the Olympics, first of all, is the most special event that I've ever been to or worked on. And I've been lucky enough to do 5 of them. And there's just something that's so special. It's just in the air. And so, you know, I think it gets translated to the fans around the world. And so I feel like it helps the growth of the game, which is important to me. If I'm an owner of a National Hockey League team, not very thrilled, really not. And I mean, John Tavares hurt his knee back, you know, a few Olympics ago and missed the last 6-7 weeks of the season, might've cost him the playoffs. You know, so I can see how they sit back and they just pray that their players don't get hurt and they don't make any money. And they just hope that their investment in their top players, that they come back healthy. So I understand that side of it as well.
So if they asked you to do a 6 Olympics for the upcoming Winter Olympics, would you do it?
That's a great question. And I've thought about that.
COVID-19 is still around, but that doesn't mean the Army ROTC programs are not there for you. Earn scholarships for school and pursue the career you want. The leadership-developing Army ROTC classes will give any full-time student the focus and resources that can open doors down the road. Start sharpening the skills that will carve out your future today. Learn how at goarmy.com/ROTC. Army ROTC, now accepting college scholarship applications. Visit goarmy.com/moneyforcollege. COVID-19 is still around, but that doesn't mean the Army ROTC programs are not there for you. Earn scholarships for school and pursue the career you want. The leadership-developing Army ROTC classes will give any full-time student the focus and resources that can open doors down the road. Start sharpening the skills that will carve out your future today. Learn how at goarmy.com/ROTC. Army ROTC, now accepting college scholarship applications. Visit goarmy.com/moneyforcollege.
I would have to think about it. You know, to go to China at this particular time in my life, I'm not, you know, that real young age anymore. And I would have to think about it. I will say this. It is, and always has been, to me, my biggest challenge as a broadcaster, to do the things that you have to try to do that are not real legal, to try to get information to, you know, to broadcast. It's really difficult. And they've made it really hard to have the type of access that I think we need to be, you know, to do it justice. So I would certainly consider it, but I can't tell you right now that I would do it.
Yeah, it could be even tougher because who knows what's going to go on. They might say, hey, Joe, come up to Stanford. We're going to have you call it off a monitor. I could only imagine how difficult that would be to call the Olympics from Connecticut.
You know, you mentioned 1994 in Lillehammer, and Jigs McDonald and I were partners, and we were doing, a lot of times we were doing two games a day. And so the two arenas that they had, the two venues, were about a 45-minute drive apart. And the one venue, they called it the Cave because it was an arena that was built inside of a mountain. It used to be a bomb shelter. And so you would get in, these huge garage doors would open and you walk right into the mountain. And inside was about a 5,000 seat arena. It was the most unbelievable thing. And so on a couple of occasions, Jigs McDonald, after doing our game, we wouldn't have time to get in the car and get to their venue. So they would turn all the lights off in the Cave, and there would be me and Jigs sitting in front of a monitor calling a game from the other arena. And so that was my first experience.
I prepared you for last season.
It did. A little bit, it did, for sure. You know, and it gave me a lot more respect for, not that I didn't before, but that really made me understand how difficult the job it is for the play-by-play person who's trying to see the numbers and the, you know, it's so difficult for them. And it really makes you appreciate even more Sam and a lot of the play-by-play people around the league that had to call the games off the monitors.
So I want to take it back to the USA Hockey National Team Development Program for a second. And I want to extend this out into kind of what they're doing with players below age 21. The team won the gold medal in the World Juniors this past winter. They've won 5 gold medals now. What one thing do you think in particular, the national team, the development program, is doing well at this particular moment over the past 10 years or so, probably since that 2010 team? I think you've seen a monumental seismic shift. Could have been losing the 2010 gold medal game to Canada, but what do you think right now that they are doing in particularly well that they weren't necessarily doing 20 to 30 years ago? Could be something that they're looking for when they scout. Is it just the players are getting bigger, stronger, faster, because that seems to be a league-wide thing and something that's all throughout sports. But I wanted to ask your opinion, considering that you seem to really do have a pulse on what's going on when it comes to the national game.
You know what, Joe? I think that what's really happened with that program, it's like I can relate that to trying to make a team growing up, you know, then trying to make the next better team, and trying to make the next better team, and then trying to get to college and make that team. What they've done with this, it's become something really special. And these kids, now they look at this as, boy, would that ever be great if I could ever play and get in that program. And so they've created this stigma of something that is very special. And if you work hard enough and you get a break and you get to try out for this team and you get selected, that you're in this elite group. And not that kids that don't make it aren't. Sometimes it's injuries. Sometimes they're just not, kids mature at different ages, right? You might be 18 or 17 or 16, whatever. And, it takes you until 21 or 23 before you really realize your potential, both physically and mentally. But what the program has done is, they've sent a message that this is something special that you should try and strive for. And look what the program's done. Look at the World Juniors. Look where a lot of these kids, what's happening with these kids after going through the program, number one picks, going to top colleges, a lot of them having good NHL careers. So I just think that they've created something that's really helped motivate so many kids from around the country. I think that's been the biggest thing, is how hard they work to try and get in the program.
Yeah, it's definitely paying off right now. We saw some great people last year in the World Juniors and then making an impact in the playoffs, of course. So it's always interesting when you see these players coming off the World Juniors or right out of college and they're able to make an impact debuting in the Stanley Cup playoffs. I can only imagine the pressure in their heads. With you, when your career, your point, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, and I agree with you, the pressure, but the other thing that happens is that they're doing a good job preparing these kids. And you mentioned getting bigger and stronger and all that. So physically is one thing, but then the other thing that it's helped them over the years is, I didn't get in front of a TV camera, until I turned pro, to get interviewed basically, maybe once in high school, when we won the state championship there a few times, but I didn't have the savviness that these kids come up with now. So now they're 18 years old and they turn pro or 19, you put a camera in front of them, it's no big deal. So they prepare them both physically and mentally.
Yeah, and especially in some of the bigger markets, you need to be able to handle yourself in the media, otherwise that could certainly backfire on you, as we've seen with many players throughout the years. When you went to make the transition into broadcasting, how did that come about for you? Did somebody reach out to you? Did you have any hesitations in saying, I don't know if I could do this? And what was it like doing those first few games for yourself as a color commentator?
I had absolutely no idea and no interest in broadcasting. Hadn't even thought about it. My only thought process was I was finished playing and we had a little baby boy, and I'm thinking, I gotta make a living. I played an era where I wasn't a top player, first of all, and you guys know about the money, what it was back then compared to what it is now. And I had to make a living. So I got in the investment business and I was trying to get that business going. And a guy by the name of Dan Kelly, who not many people see him now, but if you watch Canada Cup from 1987, the great goal that Mario Lemieux scored from Wayne Gretzky, the guy that's calling that game is Dan Kelly. And Dan Kelly, God rest his soul, died at 52 of cancer. And he was one of the great voices this game has ever seen. He was the original, on USA Network for the NHL way back when, Hockey Night in Canada. He was, I still think he's the greatest play-by-play hockey broadcaster of all time. And so he, along with doing all the national games and still working games in Canada, doing all the playoffs for Canada, he was also the play-by-play voice of the Blues, St. Louis Blues, where I played. And back in those days, the broadcasters and the players, we didn't get to know each other all that well. It's not like the way we work now, where we try to get information and talk to the players one-on-one and get to know them. So I knew Dan a little bit, not really well. And so he called me up one day and said, Joe, I want to open an account with you. I said, great. And he said, buy me 500 shares of Anheuser-Busch stock. And this was in 1984 or five. And so he became a client of mine. And, you know, and about a year later, it's late August. I'm actually up in Minnesota on business. He calls me and he said, I need an analyst on radio. And back then, St. Louis was only televising about five games a year. Everything else was on radio. And so Dan says, I need an analyst for radio. And he said, I think we'd have some fun. He said, I think we could do it. You know, he said, I think you could do it. He said, you're not going to make any money, but it'll be good for your business. And it'll get you back in the game. So he said, why don't you think about it? You know, so I did. And I said, okay. And that's how I got into business. I knew nothing about it, but I was spoiled in St. Louis and listening to Dan, Jack Buck was there. Bob Costas was there at the time. Dan Dierdorf was living in St. Louis. They were all on Sports Open Line on KMOX radio every night. And, you know, just some of the top broadcasters that have ever been around. So I was spoiled. I thought, well, you just show up at the booth and you talk when you're ready to talk, you know, when it's your turn. Well, so I'll just finish this real quickly. First game I ever worked with Dan was a preseason game. It was in Peoria, Illinois. He said, we'll get a chance to talk. I'll tell you about broadcasting before we do our first game. Of course, we never did. I show up. I don't even have a pencil on me. And we're doing the game. 7 minutes into the game, it's a preseason game against Detroit. Dan has it. He's had a patented goal call. Blues score. I say something right in the middle of his goal call. He sends it to commercial and he says to me, if you ever do that again, you're fired. I said, what did I do? Don't talk when I'm talking. So that was the start of my career. But Dan was the best thing for me. He was so honest with me. You know, he told me at times, you embarrassed yourself tonight. And I'd always say, why? Why are you saying that? And we always do it after a game, having a beer. And he'd say, I said something to you. You didn't know. You weren't prepared. You didn't know anything about players on the other team. You didn't know this. You didn't know about their power play. You didn't know about their penalty killing. You know, he says, you got to know that stuff. You know, he said, I asked you, he said, you better have an answer. And so that's how I learned. And then he would also say to me, again, we'd have a beer after a game on the road. And he'd say, you know, he said, God, he said, we were so good tonight. And I'd say, we were? And he'd say, oh, I said, well, why? Why were we good? And he'd tell me, he said, the first period, he said, I mentioned their power play and bang, he says, you were right on with your comment. You were so right. You know, the next time, you know, I mentioned something else and you told me why it happened. You know, you were right. So that's how I got to learn about broadcasting and the game. And he always told me, remember, there's two teams. Don't get caught. Just, you know, you don't want to do this business, you know, having the reputation of just being a homer. You know, get to know both teams, talk to both coaches, understand what the other team's doing. So that's how I got into the business. And I'm sorry it was such a long answer, but I love Dan Kelly like a father. And he's the one who got me in this business and taught me with some tough love the way you're supposed to do the games and how to be professional. And I've always tried to do it that way.
Yeah, it's certainly paid off, of course. So you have your little intro there to radio and television. As Joe mentioned earlier, then you spent some time behind the bench. You ultimately then joined the North Stars broadcast and then returned to the Blues before you make your way to the Islanders. You're there for a pretty good long period of time there, working with Howie Rose. And then JD, he leaves to become a president in hockey. So there's an opening there with the Rangers. I'm curious, did MSG come to you and say, hey, Joe, want to maybe slide you over? Or is that something that you actively pursued?
No, that was, I'll tell you what happened at the time. And you know, you mentioned Howie Rose, another one of my great friends. And I've been blessed, you know, to work with so many great broadcasters, Dan Kelly, Hall of Famer, Sam Rosen, Hall of Famer. You know, I worked with Howie for 8 seasons on the Islanders telecasts. And so what happened was sitting home that summer and Mike Milbury called me. And Mike was the GM, and he might have been the president of the Islanders as well. But Mike called me and he said, "I just want to give you a heads up. I got a call from MSG. And even though MSG had the rights, you know, broadcast, well, we all work for MSG, Islander broadcasters, Devils, Rangers. And Mike said, you're going to get a phone call because they called me and told me they want to talk to you about moving you over. So I didn't call. I hadn't even thought about it. I liked where I was. I liked everybody there, our crew, Howie, you know, so that's how it happened. Mike called me and gave me a heads up. And then Mike Baer, who was the president of the network at the time, called me and said, let's go have lunch. I want to talk to you about this. So that's how it happened.
Wow. Could you believe, I mean, it doesn't seem like that 15 years, this would be, 15th season, right? With Sam.
Right.
Wow. I think if NBC is listening, I think they should bring Howie Rose out of retirement just to do the Olympics. Like, that'd be a tremendous fit for Howie, missing doing hockey games. But yeah, 15 years with Sam, and you know, it seems like just yesterday, really. And we've seen all these great Ranger teams over the years, and it's been a fantastic run. I'm curious though, for you, because you were still doing, you're doing some national games. You're doing the Rangers, of course. How did you prepare for games where, especially when it comes to the playoffs, you might be doing Ranger game Monday, and then Tuesday you got to go do, you know, 2 other teams, and then you come back to do another Ranger game. How did you, you know, get in that mindset? You know, we had your colleague Kenny Albert on with us, who, I remember in the Rangers Stanley Cup run, he was flying back and forth, coast to coast every day. It wasn't as crazy as a view, but how do you just prepare for a scenario like that? Obviously it's easier when you're watching the Rangers every day, but then they're saying, "Hey, go do a Kings Oilers game." You know, you're not locked in on that.
Well, I've been lucky enough. I think a real important part of this job is to establish personal relationships with general managers, with coaches, with other broadcasters, with players.
COVID-19 is still around, but that doesn't mean the Army ROTC programs are not there for you. Earn scholarships for school and pursue the career you want. The leadership-developing Army ROTC classes will give any full-time student the focus and resources that can open doors down the road. Start sharpening the skills that will carve out your future today. Learn how at goarmy.com/ROTC. Army ROTC, now accepting college scholarship applications. Visit goarmy.com/moneyforcollege. COVID-19 is still around, but that doesn't mean the Army ROTC programs are not there for you. Earn scholarships for school and pursue the career you want. The leadership-developing Army ROTC classes will give any full-time student the focus and resources that can open doors down the road. Start sharpening the skills that will carve out your future today. Learn how at goarmy.com/ROTC. Army ROTC, now accepting college scholarship applications. Visit goarmy.com/moneyforcollege.
And so when that would happen, and it happens a lot in the playoffs, because especially in the first round, I might do 12 games in the first round and do 5 different series. And so I always try to stay ahead of it. I always watch the games. I would always make sure, like, I always think it's really important to go to a morning skate. Now, granted, this last year and a half with COVID is different because we haven't been able to, you know, get close to players or coaches. But I would always even if the game ended at midnight, of which many times it did because of overtimes, two or three overtimes, I would always take the earliest flight I could, even if I had to get up at 4 a.m, to get into the next city to get to the morning skates. And I would always call ahead of time. I'd either call coaches, text them, when's a good time? I'm coming in. Can we talk? Appreciate a few minutes. And so you get enough and you establish these relationships with these coaches, and hopefully they respect your work enough where they're not afraid to talk to you. And I've been lucky that way. And so that's because I always think if you can give the listener something that they can't read about someplace, then it's a nugget of information that the only place they can hear it was from you. And Kenny Albert's the same way, because Kenny and I have talked a lot about this, about going to a morning skate, even though you're tired and you haven't had much sleep and you worked the night before. And Kenny and I have worked a lot where we just try to get something, and then we get it and we know we're the only ones that have it. And the only ones that are going to give this information, right, it's going to be on the air tonight, and nobody else has it. And it's something that Kenny and I have always taken a lot of pride in trying to get that kind of stuff, you know. And Sam's the same way when we do Ranger stuff, because he's a tireless worker. And he also understands the importance of having personal conversations with players and coaches to get stories that that they haven't heard, that the fans haven't heard.
So who are some of the most instrumental hockey people through the years? And I especially want to touch on the time that you've had as a color commentary for the Rangers, rich storied history, original six franchise, fans show up everywhere you go. Doesn't matter where you are in the country. What people, hockey people in particular, for you have been instrumental in helping you with those nuggets of information, those tidbits, those factoids, those stats? Who in particular has helped you along probably the most?
That's it, Joe. It's a really good question. And it's a hard question to answer, because you won't get that information until somebody trusts you. And it's the same with the players. Until there's enough trust that they will give you information that they know that you will present it in the proper way. They won't say anything. And I mean, you guys hear a lot of the sports interviews, especially with a big group. There's very few Rory McIlroys out there these days, right? Where after he does an interview, you just go, you love the guy because he's so open and honest. There's not many like that anymore. Most of them are guarded. And so I think it starts with a lot of the public relations people over the years that you have to get to know. And once they kind of get a feel for who you are and then how you do games. And if I say, well, does Sid have a couple of minutes for me? I've worked with Pittsburgh. So, they'll go get Sid, and Sid knows me. So I'm lucky, I'm lucky that way, but those are just relationships. So it's the same with coaches. I mean, not all coaches are like, I mean, there's some over the years that have always been difficult and really tight-lipped with anything they say. And you're just not gonna get much from them. You know, that's just the way it is, no matter who you are. So, again, it's a great question. And I wish there was someone in particular, but the other thing that the other people that don't get enough credit for what, any successes that I've had or Sam or, you know, any, you know, anybody else, our producers, our directors that make us look good, that, you know, that start, that you can talk to during a game. I say, did you see that back behind the play? You know, it got tripped up and it turned, the guy must have stick and it turned, you know, which is why things happen. And you get these guys, you know, once you work together for a period of time, like Chris Ebert, our producer with the Rangers, and Larry Roth is our director. And I've worked with them now for a long time and we know each other. And so a lot of times they know exactly what I'm thinking, what I'm looking for. And they go and they get it before I even have to say anything. So, you know, though it's so important to work with a good crew that understands the game of hockey and understands what a good show is all about.
What is a moment in your career, whether it was playing, coaching, or now broadcasting, where you kind of, you know, we call it the, you know, I'm right moment, where maybe somebody was telling you, you know, hey, Joe, you have to do this way. And you said, well, I don't really think so. I think this way will work. And then you ended up doing it your way. And it kind of was like a, I told you so moment. Anything ever like that ever happened for you?
You know, one thing that stands out back when I was a player and I was playing for the St. Louis Blues. And back in the day, before the season would start, the head of the NHL Players Association would travel around to all the teams. And, you know, I remember when he got to our team, and it was Allan Eagleson, who ended up going to jail. He was the famous guy that represented Bobby Orr and never told Bobby that the Bruins had offered him, you know, 16% of the franchise or something, and had him sign in Chicago. And he was, you know, he was representing us. And he was trying to tell our team at the time that we should get ready to go on strike. And so he said, you got to prepare for this. So I just asked him a question. I said, Alan, I said, what percentage of the players in this room do you think can afford to go on strike? He says, 100%. I said, you're wrong, because I can't. And I'm single. And I said, a lot of my buddies here have homes and young kids. And I know I can't go. So how can they? Well, you got to stick together. I said, and I remember saying to him, I said, well, if you thought that this was going to happen, you know, why don't you have a strike fund or something for us? So, you know, but I remember that happening and there was no way, but this was all part of his deal. And I know I was right on that. As far as, you know, other things, I'm, you know, it's hard for me to pinpoint something. I know that sometimes if you predict something on the air and it goes right, that it makes you look smart. But sometimes you just get a feel, you know, sometimes you get a feel early on for a player. And sometimes you say, hey, let's keep an eye on this guy tonight. You know, it just looks like something's going to happen, or, you know, so I've been lucky enough for those. But, you know, when you start trying to predict something, you know, most of the time you're going to be wrong, but that's a risk you should take. You know, you should take it. That's what this is all about. So that wasn't a really good answer for you guys. I'm sorry. I mean,
that was a great answer.
It's a great answer.
That story. Yeah. It was incredible. So, Joe, of course, we're having you on. We have to ask you some Rangers questions. Sure. I firmly believe here it's time for the Rangers to name a captain. Seems like ever since mm-hmm. they don't have a captain, they haven't made the playoffs. Is that coincidental? Maybe, maybe not. Who, if it was up to you, or if they gave you some sort of input, would you say is the best candidate to be the captain of the Rangers?
I would say that there's a couple. To me, there's two. And, you know, what I missed about the last year and a half, or the way we've had to cover these games, is that, you know, we weren't able to be around any players or coaches like all of last year. We only, you know, talk to them on Zoom, which is a terrible way to do things. And so generally you're in the locker room, as far as I, you know, what the job I do, you're in the locker room, you get a good, real good feel for everybody, you know, who's doing what, who's respected, how they look at players on the team, how the coaches do. And so being absent of that the last season, I have to go mostly on, you know, two seasons ago, and just watching what I see on the ice and in talking to people. And so I think there's two. I think there's Jacob Trouba, is to me a really strong candidate. And then the other one, if you want to put the pressure on a 23, 24 year old, is Adam Fox. The thing with Trouba is when something needs to be said or something needs to be done on the ice, he does it. And he does it for his team. And in addition to that, he is, he's really a quality player that, you know, he's not necessarily in the same role now with the Rangers that he was with Winnipeg when they needed somebody to play the power play and he had a 50-point season. So he could do that if you need him to do that. But he's not needed in that role here. And yet he accepts it. He's never batted an eye about not getting much power play time. And because everybody likes to score, everybody likes to get points. That's human nature. So I think he's got all the qualities that a good captain has to have. So he would be one. And Adam Fox, I just think, is not only is he a great player, and game in and game out does the same thing, but he's got a maturity about him, and he's highly respected amongst his teammates and around the league. And I think that even though I think Adam Fox would be a little quieter, then I don't think he's going to get up and scream and yell and do that and get in somebody's face like Jacob Trouba could. But I think he would be an excellent captain and an excellent representative of the Rangers and their organization for this city. So that's what those are the two I would look at.
So we all know that the Rangers have a lot of really tremendous top end talent. And a lot of that talent has come within the last couple of years here. They've been very fortunate in the draft a couple of years ago. They took two guys who I believe are going to make an impact this season. Vitaly Kratsov replacing Pavel Buchnevich and Kjandre Miller. And then they took Kapokako, and then they took Alexei Lafreniere. And you can go right on down the list. Mika Zibanejad, Artemi Panarin, Chris Kreider. Kreider, I'm sure, will be another guy who I think will be in that very small pool of players that the organization is kind of gearing towards giving the C to. But I wanted to bring up the last couple of seasons. I think the Rangers did a lot of really good things. As comes with the New York media, I think a lot of people, probably myself included at times, were maybe a little too unfair on David Quinn. I think he did a lot of really great things here. I thought you saw Buchnevich become a much more complete all-around player. Obviously, now he's in St. Louis after the trade. I thought you saw a lot of really great strides from somebody like Ryan Strom, who didn't really have a place on his previous teams, but it seems like he's found a place here. He's got tremendous chemistry with Panarin, very elite chemistry that only a couple of duos, I think, in the entire league have. So we know the Rangers are top-end heavy, a lot of talent up top, but it was kind of rounding out the rest of the roster, the rest of the lineup, where I think they kind of ran into issues here the last couple of seasons and ultimately why they fell short of the playoffs. So Chris Drury, who is now the general manager, went out in the offseason, made a couple moves to make that possible, made the trade for Barkley Goodrow, who just won back-to-back Stanley Cup titles in Tampa. They went out and they traded for Ryan Reeves, who seems like he's going to start the season on the fourth line. They've shuffled out a couple of defensemen here. So in your opinion, now that we're getting ready for the start of the regular season, do you ultimately think that the Rangers did enough to round out the hard edges and the secondary spots in the lineup? And do you think that's going to be enough, in addition with the coaching change with Jared Gallant coming in, to push this team to go into the playoffs?
I would say this, Joe. In order to win in this league at a high level, or win the Stanley Cup, you know, there's a lot of elements that have to work. You know, you obviously have to have some highly talented players. You know, you look at Tampa Bay. You have to have great goaltending. And in the case of the Rangers, when they decided 3 years ago that this was the new course that they were going to take, that everyone had agreed that even though they were still a pretty good team, that they weren't good enough and didn't have enough pieces in the organization to win a championship. When they all agreed on that, you know, Jim Dolan, the owner, said, well, I want to win championships. So if this isn't good enough to win championships, then let's blow it up and try start again. So now when I think about where this team is, and yes, the additions that they added were needed, but a few other things are going to happen in order for the Rangers to get to that next level. Mika Zibanejad is going to have to get back to being the player that he was a year and a half ago, where he was arguably for a year and a half.
Every day, thousands of hackers try to steal your crypto. But Arculus uses air-gapped technology by forming a protective barrier that insulates you from hackers and secures your crypto. Order yours at getarculus.com.
A top 10 player in the game. When the game was on the line, he was doing something. I mean, he was fabulous. Killing penalties, power play, even strength, wanted the puck. You know, he was doing everything, setting up teammates. I don't know what happened at the beginning of last year. I know he got COVID, and maybe that was it. There was some talk that he changed his diet and his workout routine and that kind of thing. And even though his numbers show that he had a better second half last year, he still, in the second half, wasn't the kind of player that he had been for that year and a half that I was talking about, where in the big games, he was front and center. So he's got to get back to that. And plus, it's a contract year for him, too. So he's got to get back to that level. These young players that we have been watching now for 3 years get drafted, playing the minors, playing the KHL, Kravtsov, you mentioned, are now, like as an example, you know, Philip Hedel, he just turned 22 a couple of weeks ago. He's had five training camps with the Rangers. Five. Kaapo Kakko just turned 20. You know, he's in his third season with the Rangers. And back, Larry Brooks and I were talking today when we were watching practice, and Kaapo Kakko stopped and was right in front of us on the ice. And Larry said, he said, look at his face. He said, he doesn't have baby fat anymore. And it's true. You know, it's true. These kids are 18. They come over. They're not fit. Most of them are not physically developed as they will be. And so he's worked hard. He looks like a different player. He's still only 20. So my point is that you still have to have your top players perform at a high level. They've added some important pieces because everybody knows if you're going to try and get through the grind of the playoffs, your team better have some toughness and some grind and some penalty killers and, you know, have that. And Barkley Goodrow, I love this. I loved his sign. Loved it. And plus, he can pass on to all these other players what it takes to win Stanley Cups, as can Sammy Blais, who came over from the Blues in the Buchnevich deal. So that's an element that, and I think the organization knew that after seeing these kids that they were drafting and watching, I think they knew that that was something that they were going to have to bring in. And so now you need those young players to take the next step. And how many of them are, is Kapo Kakko now going to be a top six player? So far he looks like it. Is Philip Hedl, who had a great start last year before getting hurt, where's his game going to be? You mentioned Kravtsov. He came up, didn't have a lot of points, but opened some eyes in the 20 games he played. Is he going to be able to make that next step? Lafreniere, you know, worked hard in the offseason, got a taste of it last year, highly talented kid, great attitude. You know, how much better is he going to be this year? Keandre Miller. Nobody expected this kid to step in and do what he did. And then not only did he step in, but they just had him play against every team's best player, you know, all season. You know, and you're going, wow, this kid is looks like he's could be really special. He worked hard in the offseason. He's got more confidence this year. So how good is he going to be? So there's still all these question marks. It's not just one thing, you know, it's not just the youth, but it's the veterans and it's the players that were brought in and what effect are they going to have? And then it's Shesterkin, you know, is he going to be as good as we think he's going to be? So there's a lot of things that, you know, there's a lot of things that it takes to get to that point where you can, you know, where you can actually be a championship team.
No doubt about it. And last point for me here, as we begin to wrap, we're all circling Henrik Lundqvist's jersey retirement ceremony. Yeah. It's going to be a very emotional evening. And, you know, I really think him along with John Tortorella kind of made the Rangers like an elite team. I really think when Tortorella came around 2009, it's really when the Rangers kind of took off and the expectations were sky high, even though Tom Rennie did a really good job after the lockout. I had the privilege of sitting in one of these. I just wanted to ask you, is there anything in hockey quite like sitting in on a John Tortorella press conference?
You know, it's Torts and I have had our times. You know, we've known each other for so long. And I mean, to the point where in 04, when Tampa Bay won the Stanley Cup, and I did the finals, Dave Strader, another, you know, God rest his soul. Dave and I did 13 straight years of Stanley Cup finals for international television. And so we were working that series. And after the series, you know, I went down, I made a point to go down to John's office afterwards and see him and congratulate him. And we hugged each other. Then when he comes to the Rangers, you know, I see him and I said, can I give you a call? I said, no, I'm too busy. I'm trying. I said, how about tomorrow? No. And so he came in mid-season, right? Or towards the end of the season. So then at the end of the season, I went in to see him. And he said, what's up? I said, here's what's up. I said, 2004, you and I have had this great relationship. We've always spent 20 minutes at least talking about your team when you've been the coach of another team. I said, 04, I go down and see you after win the whole thing. I said, you come here and now I can't get 2 minutes with you in the middle of January. And I said, what's that? But that was him too. You know, that was him. And so, you know, there were times when we'd get mad at each other, and then he's a unique personality. And I agree with you that, you know, sometimes teams just need a certain personality. Doesn't mean that the guy that got fired was a bad coach, but it's a different personality. And you know, we were talking about, you know, earlier about my knee replacement I had, and I was told that the doctor did mine also did Torts's hip. And he said he wouldn't use the cane when he finished. He wouldn't use. So I sent him a text. I said, "Quit being so stubborn." I said, "When the doctor tells you to gotta use the cane, you know." So we had some laughs, and that's when he told me he was going to be doing some television this year. And
yeah, he's going to be great for ESPN.
He's a coach like him. But he was classic, and still is. And you know, he hasn't changed much over years. He still has his beliefs and what he thinks it takes to win and how people should act. And God love him. He's given sound bites that will never get stale. That's for sure.
In the spirit of former captain Ryan Callahan, I have one more question for you. From your vantage point, we'll stay with current players. We'll stay with players maybe that you've gotten to speak to over the last couple of years here, coaches over the last couple of years. Maybe you can include general managers here in this. Which person in particular, and the reason why I mentioned Callahan is because I used to do stuff for NHL Network, NHL.com, so had an opportunity to see him, maybe not meet him in person. I did have the opportunity to meet Kevin Weeks. He's since moved on. Which person do you think in particular has the chops or has the scout, the talent and the skill set to eventually make the transition over to do broadcasting one day?
So you're talking about current players?
Current players, current coaches,
current player.
Anybody that you've encountered. Who do you think, because again, you work with Sam, if there's anybody who's going to know this, it's you. Who do you think has a potential future in broadcasting?
Yeah, play-by-play is a lot different. I think you have to be trained, you know, and not that you don't have to be trained to be an analyst and learn, and learn the ropes. You should. In fact, I think everybody should go through a training period and, you know, earn your stripes. That's what I think. I think you should earn your stripes before you. I think this, of the current Rangers, like Ryan Strome is great. Ryan Strome is I don't know if I want to say a deep thinker, but he gives answers that are well thought out and he speaks well, you know, and you can throw something at him and he'll give you a great answer. And he'll give you, I think, something that maybe you hadn't thought about. And so Ryan Strome would certainly be someone to me that would be excellent at doing this job, either in the booth, in the, you know, in the studio, like Steve Aliquette. You know, Steve's made a tremendous move from being a player to being really, really good at what he does. And it's a lot of it's just his personality and his willingness to talk and think and work, you know, and that's, you know, that's the thing. There's, you know, this is another thing that Dan Kelly told me. He said, you gotta work at this job. You gotta talk. You gotta go ask those coaches what's on their mind, what they're thinking about. He says, because you know what, Joe? He said, as a former player, you can only get by with, well, when I played, he said, that doesn't last very long because you get to a point, nobody gives a shit. That's what Dan, excuse my language, but that's what he said. So you have to treat this. So part of the answer to this is then who would take this and take those attributes and say, okay, this is a new profession. I'm not going to get by just being a former player, even for the great players, which I was not. So you have to be able to and want to work and be good at it. And you mentioned Ryan Callahan. He's someone he's working at this. You know, he works hard at this, and it's great to see because I love the guy personally. Loved him as a player. His teammates loved him. Fans love him. For what I do, I love him. And to see him take the work ethic that he had as a player and as a captain and take that to this business is something that I think is just awesome.
Must be Ryan, right? Ryan Callahan, Ryan Strome, who knows?
I guess that's it. Ryan Whitney's doing a great job.
He is doing a great job. It is Ryan. Who knows? Maybe I'll name my kid Ryan. But I wanted to end this by bringing up somebody Nick and I had on recently. We had Brendan Burke on, the Isles play-by-play guy, on a couple weeks ago. And the story of how you started kind of doing something impromptu with the Blues organization is kind of how he started. He was the radio guy for the Peoria, and then he kind of was brought into the booth, you know, kind of on a whim. His entire career has taken off since then, and it seems like no matter what happens, MSG always figures out a way to have the best of the best, the elite talent, talent that not only works in-house over there for the MSG network, but they figure out a way to do other stuff. You, Kenny, Burke now is going to join the TNT team when they start broadcasting games here in a very short period of time as we get ready for the season. So last thing here, we always give our guests the last words. So Joe, if there's anything else you would like to share or promote, we thank you for giving us a little bit of extra time. We know your time is precious. We hope you and your big family, hope you guys stay safe as we continue to, you know, hopefully come through the home stretch here of the pandemic. We wish you and Sam the best of luck this season. Let's go Rangers. Hopefully we can make a playoff push, but if there's anything else you would like to share or promote, go right ahead. The floor is all yours. Thanks again for doing this with us.
Well, I'll say this. First of all, I appreciate being on with you guys. And I hope we get to do it again. There's always so many things that we can talk about. And so I appreciate that, first of all. And, you know, you guys have been very kind to me. I've been the luckiest guy in the world. I mean, look at the people that I've been able to work with and learn from. And it started with Dan Kelly. And then it went to, you know, Ken Wilson, Ken Wilson called Pete Rose's record-breaking hit. You know, so he was great at hockey. He was great at baseball. So I worked with Ken there. Sam obviously has, you know, been a legend for many years and will continue to be. Howie Rose, the great Dave Hodge, who was, you know, one of the great hockey broadcasters in Canada for years. I worked with him my first television gig in Minnesota, and he taught me so much. I mentioned this a little bit earlier. You know, so many people behind the scenes that work so hard, and they end up making me look good because of what they do. And to all the coaches and the players, you know, it doesn't matter what job. Look at you guys. You know, look how hard you guys work, you know, to make this a great show. You don't sit around and wait to get lucky. You have to work at it, but we all get breaks. I mean, what if Dan Kelly didn't call me? I look back at that and I'm so lucky. And then to have a wife like I've had for 40 years now, that said, you go work, I'll take care of the kids. And that's what we've done. So I've had her to allow me to do all the traveling I've had to do to make a living, because I've been petrified that, you know, my father always told me, and we didn't give any money, but it's your responsibility. You got to make a living. You got to make a living for your kids, your family, and take care of them. You know, so I've always thought that's what I got to do. And then, you know, so you get a chance, try to take advantage of it by working hard and try to be as kind as you can to the people that you deal with and you run into in life. And, you know, that's what my mother always said. It doesn't cost you anything to be nice to people. So be nice to people. And sometimes, you know, I think it's the only way to be, you know? So anyway, the point is that this isn't about me. It's about all the people that I've been lucky enough to work with that have helped me along the way. And I am forever grateful for having those relationships with people.
Joe, very well said. Yeah. Great way to end the show. We appreciate it. As your broadcast partner always says, it's a power play goal. This was a power play interview. It was dynamic. It was awesome. We do appreciate it. And that's going to do it here for this episode of You Know I'm Right. So for our very special guest, Joe Micheletti, and my co-host, Joe Calabrese, I am Nick Durst, and this has been You Know I'm Right.
You might have noticed a change in your neighborhood lately. Yep, Sprint stores are now T-Mobile stores. Now that Sprint is T-Mobile, you get more coverage, value, and benefits than ever before. We've invested billions to bring our 5G from big cities to small towns across America. And great coverage is just the start. From high-speed mobile hotspot data to weekly deals and giveaways, our customers get tons of great benefits. Head to your new T-Mobile store to learn more.
Qualifying service and capable device required. Coverage not available in some areas. Some uses may require certain plan or features. See T-Mobile.com.